Hello, everyone. Welcome to Lab Medicine's podcast series. My name is Kelly Swales, and I'm the web editor for Lab Medicine. Joining me today is Dr. Michael Diamond. He's a professor of medicine, microbiology, and immunology, and the head of the Division of Infectious Diseases and Vaccine Development at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri. He's going to talk with us today about the Zika virus. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us, Dr. Diamond.
My pleasure.
I'd like to take a moment to talk to our listeners a little bit about the Zika virus itself.
Well, the Zika virus is one that scientists have known about for quite some period of time, although it has not been studied for many years. It was identified in the 1940s and 1950s in the Zika forest in Africa. And it's related to a family of viruses that cause mosquito-transmitted diseases globally, ones that people might know better. For example, in the developing world, dengue virus, which infects 390 million people a year. And here in the United States, people are probably familiar with West Nile virus, which has caused outbreaks on a yearly basis since 1999. This virus, historically, really didn't cause much disease as far as we know when it was in Africa and other parts of the world. Only about 1 in 5 people actually got any symptoms at all, and 4 out of 5 people who were infected really either did not even know they were infected or had almost no symptoms and therefore didn't report it. The virus somehow or another has seemed to change over the past several years. It's not clear if the virus has changed or if it's moved into a different population group or if there's some other factors that we're not understanding. But this virus, which normally caused mild fever and conjunctivitis, inflammation of the eyes, a rash, and some muscle pain and joint pain and went away in about a week, now appears to cause more significant clinical syndromes, two of which are certainly concerning to clinicians as well as to public health people. One of them being microcephaly, which many people have heard, where there's a congenital infection from a mother to the developing baby, and the baby can go on to develop significant neurologic problems, including a small head and some brain development problems. And then also another disease called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a neurologic disease, which we're not totally clear whether it's absolutely associated with this virus or it's an immune response to the virus. But there seems to be an epidemiologic linkage with this other disease. So basically we have a virus in a family that we know a lot about, the virus that wasn't causing much disease, and then since about 2007 in certain parts of the world seemed to become more epidemic, and certainly since 2014, 2015 has moved into South America and Central America and up into Puerto Rico now into Mexico, and now we have some imported cases in the United States.
So can you tell us a little bit about the mode of transmission for the Zika virus? I'd also like for you, if you can, to talk about maybe the potentiality for sexual transmission and transmission through transfusion.
Right. So the dominant principal mode of transmission is mosquito bite. This is because the virus replicates well in certain species of mosquito, in this case the tiger mosquito, Aedes aegypti, and the mosquito will replicate the virus and then it goes into its salivary glands, and then when the mosquito bites, it injects it directly underneath the skin into the human, and that's the dominant mode of transmission. However, we've seen other modes of transmission, not just for Zika virus, but also for the related viruses. For example, you mentioned blood transfusion. It is possible that people become what we call viremic, meaning they have virus in their blood, and they may not have any symptoms at all. As I said, 4 out of 5 people don't have any symptoms, and then they go and they feel healthy and they donate blood. And in theory, the virus could get into the blood supply. So this is a potential concern, although my understanding is that there are no documented cases of this happening yet, although it is certainly a concern from what we know about other viruses. For example, back in 2003 with West Nile virus, there were documented cases of West Nile virus occurring through blood transfusion, and then they implemented blood screening tests, which then stopped it basically and reduced it to a very, very, very low level to make the blood supply safe. So there is concern about this, although I have not seen definitive reports showing it, although certainly I think that this could happen. There are definitive reports for sexual transmission. Again, these are very rare, likely, based upon our understanding of the epidemiology. But there's some documented cases. There was a scientist who actually went to a field area, got infected, came back, and then his partner got infected subsequently, and she had not been in an exposed area, and they traced it to sexual transmission. This was a few years ago. And then more recently, there's been a couple of other cases which have now been documented as sexual transmission. The other thing that has been found is that in the seminal fluid of a man, they've been able to detect viral RNA, and even, I believe, in one case, they've been able to isolate virus from that fluid. And one major question that we don't know is, if during an acute infection, a man gets infected and the virus can go to the testes and actually replicate there, how long does the virus actually stay there and how long is he infectious? And this is a question that we just do not have an answer for yet. And therefore, it's actually difficult to make a recommendation. When is it absolutely safe and is the person actually cleared the infection, even though the rest of their body may feel fine, do they still have any virus there? And this is not just for Zika virus, but it's also for other viruses. If you may remember, this was a situation that came up in Ebola virus in Africa, where people had cleared Ebola, they felt better, a small number of people that actually get better, but then they were able to detect Ebola virus or Ebola virus RNA in their seminal fluid for quite some period of time. And so there have been questions as to how long this would last. So dominant mode of transmission is mosquito. There is sexual transmission. It's probably pretty rare. Blood transfusion, it's likely to occur, although, again, also will be rare. And then, of course, there's the maternal transmission, which is the pregnant mom gets infected, and then the data now suggests that the virus can actually cross the placenta and infect in utero a developing fetus.
So let's talk a little bit about laboratory diagnosis. Right now, the samples are being sent to state laboratories, and in some cases, then in turn, sent to the CDC. Can you speak a little bit about the methodology of these tests?
Yeah, there's a few different tests. There's one that I would call there's a few that are better than others. There's a gold standard, which very few labs can do, which is you isolate the virus. And of course, you have to have the right facility and the right expertise. So most labs cannot do this reliably. So this is not really one that's done practically in the field, except perhaps at CDC labs or federal labs that have the capacity and the expertise to do it. So really, we're dealing with two other types of tests. One which looks for the viral RNA, the viral nucleic acid. So these viruses, they're little particles, and in them they have their own little RNA, and that sequence that they have of their RNA is unique. And you can detect that sequence using specialized tests to amplify the viral RNA. And this test works when somebody has active viral particles and viral RNA in their blood, or other fluid that they may be testing. In some places in the world, they're testing urine. In other places, they're testing saliva. And we've seen that viral RNA can last in these fluids as well. So that test detects active viral RNA. And it's quite specific. I should say it's quite specific, but it's not that sensitive. Meaning, you have a very narrow window when you might actually have the virus in a particular bodily fluid, in this case, blood. And so you may still be infected, but you may not have a lot of virus in the blood, and therefore you may not be able to detect it. If you do detect it, it's a very specific test and gives you a very secure diagnosis. So that's one class that detects the viral RNA. The other class is basically detecting antibodies against the virus, so your immune response responds to the virus and generates antibodies which specifically recognize the virus. And this happens after the phase in which the virus is in the blood. Usually the virus goes down from the blood and is no longer detectable because antibodies are helping to clear the virus out from the blood. So over a period of time, after the first week to the second week, you begin to transition from being RNA positive to an antibody negative to RNA negative in the blood and then antibody positive. The problem with the antibody tests is that there's significant cross-reactivity with other flaviviruses that circulate in globally. And the big problem is dengue, because in most of the places right now in Brazil and Central America and South America and Mexico in Puerto Rico, there is a high prevalence of dengue around, so it's very difficult to distinguish whether the antibodies were generated against acute Zika infection, acute dengue infection, or a Zika infection on the backdrop of having dengue in the past. And so we need better diagnostic reagents which will be able to distinguish those. There are some tests that can be done that could give you a pretty definitive answer, but many of the times the answer is equivocal, and so we're not certain using a antibody or serologic based test.
Well, that sort of leads into my next question, Dr. Diamond, about any sort of cross reactivity that lab professionals, pathologists, and clinicians should look out for. Meaning, if there's a particular test that if that's positive, maybe it should send up a red flag for Zika.
So there's two types of serologic tests where cross-reactivity will come into play. One of them is what we do is an acute test where we measure the IgM. That's the first antibody that gets generated in response to a viral infection. And if you have an IgM that is reactive with Zika virus, and not a negative for other flaviviruses. In this case, it's likely negative for dengue or negative for yellow fever, depending upon where you are in the world, then that's likely to be a Zika virus infection because you're not showing cross-reactivity. The problem is if your IgM is positive for Zika and it's positive for dengue, then you don't know, is it Zika, is it dengue, or did somebody have two infections like that were temporally spaced but you're still positive for one and you were just unlucky to get two infections over a period of time? Because remember, the mosquitoes circulate the viruses, co-circulated, it's certainly possible. So if you have both positive, it is almost impossible to actually make a diagnosis. If you have a single one positive, you're on better ground for it. And then there's a second test, which is, as opposed to just measuring the antibody against the viral protein, actually looks to see whether you can inhibit the virus from infecting cells. And that's called a neutralization test. It's a functional test, and basically you pre-incubate serum with the virus and look to see if you can inhibit it. The problem there is that if you did that just with Zika virus, you might see antibodies against dengue, which actually could inhibit Zika virus infection. And this has been reported in the literature. So you have to actually do a neutralization assay side by side with Zika and with dengue, and it would have to be very convincing for high levels of neutralization for Zika and virtually no level of neutralization for dengue to be able to make a diagnosis. Otherwise, if it's intermediate, you just don't know whether it's cross-reactive antibodies in one direction or the other, which could be interfering with the interpretation of the test.
This is sounding much more complex than it looks on the face of it.
That's why only specialized labs are doing the neutralization-based tests, and whereas the PCR test can be done by the CDC, but presumably by state labs, because it's very definitive if you find the diagnosis. However, if you don't find it, it's negative data. You don't know whether they don't have it or you just didn't catch them at the right time.
Let's talk a little bit about next steps for laboratory professionals and pathologists, if there's anything that we can do as a profession moving forward. Or is it just sort of a wait and see in terms of what happens next?
I think that outside of somebody actually having diagnostic acumen and actually trying to generate new tests, there are a number of both public sector and private sector groups that are trying to generate more specific tests. From a standpoint of what a pathologist can do is, if they certainly have diagnostic acumen and can help validate tests, this would be, you know, an important thing to do, especially if they're in an area where, let's say, Zika emerges. If it's in the Gulf states, for example, where we do have the mosquito. Right now, we have not had local transmission. But if we did, then somebody who's in a pathology lab might be able to help evaluate how good our tests really are relative to gold standards, either virus isolation or viral nucleic acid isolation. The other thing is to be aware for detection of, in the blood supply, and certainly being aware and actually monitoring it very carefully for those who are in laboratory medicine disciplines. And then the other thing, I think, is obviously to think of the diagnosis, and so whether you're in a pathology lab in a certain part of the country, and which may not necessarily be Zika endemic, but there are travelers coming back and forth. And so if you see a clinical history that is suspicious for it, but the laboratory tests have not been ordered, to think about that and to think about whether it's time to alert the clinicians that, you know, there is this virus going around, has some of the same symptoms, and you ordered this test, did you consider this diagnosis? So I think that they certainly have multiple roles to play, even if they're not necessarily on the vanguard of developing new diagnostic tests themselves.
And that's always the watchword, isn't it? Having the open dialogue with the clinicians and let them know what we know.
Correct.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today, Dr. Diamond. I do appreciate your expertise, and I know our listeners do as well.
Thank you very much.